My name is Noel O'Connell, and I am the CEO of European Movement Ireland. Welcome to this next episode in our Just the Chats podcast series, where we take a closer look at all things Ireland, Europe, the EU, and further afield. This week's Just the Chats podcast has a Brussels flavour to it. I'm delighted that we're joined this week by Naomi O'Leary, Europe correspondent of the Irish Times, and host of her own excellent The Irish Passport podcast series. And really pleased as well to be joined by our own, if I can put it that way, Chair of European Movement Ireland's Brussels branch, David Garrahy. A very warm welcome to you both. Really appreciate your time and very much looking forward to our conversation. David, if I might turn to you first. Of course, in the world BC before COVID, you and I would be gearing up for our Brussels Connection event in the Perm Rep in Brussels. How time has changed, how circumstances have changed. How are you and yours keeping? I hope you're all keeping well and safe, both in Brussels and your family back here in Ireland, David.
Yeah, it's quite a changed landscape, I think, in terms of, Brussels and the Brussels family is either scattered to the four winds or across the continent, or a lot of them are here in Brussels still, but we don't meet each other as much anymore. My family I was born with are thankfully all safe in Doolin, County Clare, and we fingers crossed everyone stays that way.
And have you had a chance even to come home or travel between green lists and non-green lists?
I was thinking about it the other day. It's been about nearly 11 months now that I haven't been in Ireland, and it's the longest period I haven't been in Ireland of all my life. So it's quite tough, I think, for people over here in Brussels that you know, would be used to going back and forth or might have jobs that allow them to go back and forth. It's either very, very difficult or people just don't do it anymore. We all understand the situation, but, you know, sometimes we do, you can't help but get a little bit emotional about it.
Sure. Goodness, David, I can only imagine. And it's certainly difficult and challenging times, because as we know, that Belgian-Irish connection of over and back, hopping on a plane to, you know, Zaventem or Charleroi, it was just, we never thought about it, right?
It was like a bus almost, you know, and it was the same people you'd see on the bus going back forth, you know. It was very normal, and now that's all been disrupted. I think as you know, a lot of people have, you know, flexibility from their jobs, and they have been able to move back to Ireland and work from Ireland.
Right.
A lot of the people don't have that flexibility as well. They have to work, they have their families, their lives here in Brussels, and they definitely do feel that separation from Ireland. Let's see how things go. I mean, I think the new green list, or whatever they're going to call it, is being negotiated right now at EU level. Ireland has said that they're going to sign into that. So let's see what's possible. I think, you know, cases are quite high, especially in Brussels. So it may not be that Belgium will be on the green list at the start. But I think a lot of people in the Brussels community are looking at Christmas and wondering how that's going to go in terms of kind of being at home with their families or not.
And tell me, David, from a Brussels perspective, presumably the same restrictions apply in Belgium as here in terms of COVID public health guidelines, mask wearing. Is it 2 meters social distancing? Are the bars open? I refuse to use the wet and dry pubs or something. I don't know. What is the current state of play in Brussels?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are in a strange situation where the numbers continue to rise, but they've actually started to take away some of the restrictions. So I think from Thursday, the obligatory mask wearing isn't obligatory anymore on the street.
Wow.
Which I think, you know, makes sense to some extent, but also maybe gives the wrong signal. that you know, things are getting better when they're actually not. Bars and pubs are open since a good few months, and there doesn't seem to be much of an issue there. I think the issue, from what I understand, as in Ireland, seems to be social gatherings in the home. There's an especially high rate among 20 to 30 year olds, and that, you know, that's you know, similar trends that, you know, we've seen or have said to be seen in Ireland, I think. So yeah, I mean, life is more livable here in Brussels, I get the impression, than it is in Dublin right now, or in Ireland. I get, you know, I'm mostly from social media and talking with family, etc. I get the impression things are quite strict, and, you know, very little is allowed. Whereas in Belgium, I get the feeling, you know, most things are allowed. Theatre has started, cinemas are going, music has started, you know, with social distancing. It is 1.5 meters here, so it's a little bit more space. And that, and I think that has allowed some of the bigger venue capacities to continue. You know, because September is generally when the kind of cultural season starts here in Belgium, and it's nice to see that that's still happening, even though, of course, some people won't want to take that risk.
Sure. So the moral of the story is, if you want to get anything cultural, it's taking place in Belgium at the moment, I think.
The cultural crossroads of Europe, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, actually, on that point, and on the crossroads of Europe, continuing our Brussels flavored theme to this episode of our Just the Chats podcast, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by the Irish Times Europe correspondent and host and moderator of her own excellent podcast, the Irish Passport, Naomi O'Leary. Naomi, welcome to EM Ireland's Just the Chats podcast. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much for joining us. And I think David's in Belgium. Are you across the border in the Netherlands? Have I that right?
No, I'm in Brussels.
Ah, okay. You're in Brussels. Forgive me. I must have been reading an article where you were talking about how the Dutch government was dealing with all the COVID restrictions and what approach they were taking. So I incorrectly came to the conclusion that you were living in the Netherlands. Apologies.
That's okay. I mean, I do come back and forth a bit. I've been reporting in the Netherlands as well on the approach there, which is one of the outliers in Europe, I suppose. It's a bit like Sweden, but gets a lot less attention, which is quite interesting. They've never gone in for face masks and never really had a lockdown in the sense of the word, as it's understood elsewhere. So it's a little bit of an interesting case in terms of if you want to compare COVID policies in different countries.
Yeah, for sure. And Naomi, your own role, as it says correctly in your title, is Europe correspondent with the Irish Times. You have such an incredibly broad and wide-ranging brief. How do you manage to keep a handle on what's going on across the continent, so to speak?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, obviously, we have a network of correspondents like Derek Scally in Berlin and in Paris and covering Eastern Europe as well. So I'm not totally on my own. But yeah, it is a huge brief. And it's always a question of what do you not cover? So yeah, you have to make some tough decisions. But at the same time, such an incredibly broad brief it's quite fascinating, because you can bring together pan-European trends and look at, you know, something at a continental level. So for example, I did a piece on looking at what happened in homes for the elderly across the continent, and having that freedom to kind of look at a trend in a broader perspective and compare different countries. It can actually be quite informative in terms of, you know, understanding what's happening.
For sure. And Naomi, are you seeing much of a challenge as to how you go about your job as a journalist in working through the COVID pandemic, because presumably it's harder to have those water cooler conversations or those quiet little coffee catch-ups in these times.
Yeah, I started in a very atypical time. So I think I started at the end of February, this job, and like I was in the commission, you know, the commission's daily press briefing. And there was about a week of normality, or not quite normality, but kind of teetering on the edge, with what it seemed institutional denial that a pandemic was about to hit us. And then suddenly, you know, in a chaotic fashion, everything fell apart. The borders went up, everything was cancelled, nothing was planned for, nothing was deliberate, everything was supposed to be going on as normal until the very last minute when, you know, in a kind of atmosphere of panic, things started to be cancelled. And then, of course, we had the very strict lockdown. So, yeah, it's been a little bit atypical. I'm full of admiration for how people have adapted. So there's been great efforts, particularly by the institutions, to adapt to online. They set up very complex press briefings that happen online that allow us to ask questions in different languages, get responses in different languages, and there's often simultaneous translation. And I'm full of admiration for how they've managed to set that up. And you know that they are making efforts to do that. Things have changed in that, of course, you don't meet people casually. You're not physically gathering in the same places all the time, so there's less of that sort of casual chat in person. But having said that, I mean, a lot of people have observed that the kind of trends in terms of moving towards digital and technology were things that were underway anyway. Right. So I have to say, for me, it's quite normal. Like I'm used to being a correspondent and kind of being not based in a bureau or an office that I go to every day. So for me, you know, speaking to people on the phone, WhatsApp groups, you know, dialing in, this isn't too out of the norm for me, but I understand for the Brussels press corps, it is a big change.
It is a big change, right? So you were probably just figuring out where the water coolers were located when the shutters came down fairly rapidly. But it sounds like you've more than managed to overcome any of those challenges and really embrace the digital world.
It can have upside and downsides. So I do think that like a combination of both is best. Like obviously, you to build a rapport with people, it's really, really helpful to meet face to face. That, you know, that can kind of speed things up. But at the same time, when you are doing more reporting and you're not physically having to trek across town from one press event to another press event, it actually causes quite a lot of efficiencies. So just like the time reduced from like useless hours spent, whether in like driving or in taxis or in planes, that you can spend that time much more efficiently. So you can, you know, do a lot more reporting in a way. That's at least my experience.
Right. And David, would you find that as well in terms of your own job and your role? Obviously, you're our esteemed chair of our Brussels branch, and we're hugely grateful to you and all the committee for all the hard work that you do in that regard. But do you find, a bit like Naomi, that to use the word that everyone is using at the moment, everything is pivoting online. Do you find that in terms of your own work and your day job, so to speak?
Yeah, I think I do. I find it a lot of my work has gone online in terms of meetings with colleagues, in different places that normally would be very carbon wasting flights across the world. What I find difficult, because I'm in my day job, I do advocacy for an animal welfare charity. It's that little bit more difficult to get, coalitions of MEPs meeting together, trying to build momentum behind certain campaigns, because you know you can't have that launch event, you can't have that kind of physical manifestation of the support from MEPs or from the commission. Finding it a little bit more difficult to get meetings with policymakers. You know, unless you have an established connection. So yeah, still finding challenges, and I think they're probably unique to the lobbying world over here in Brussels a bit.
Right, okay. Do you get a sense, both of you actually, I'd be interested in this, in Ireland, and I think, David, it struck me when you were talking about not having been the longest since you have returned home to Ireland. Equally for me, as you were talking, I kind of was thinking to myself, this is the longest, coming up to probably a year or so, that I haven't been in Brussels, right? So that's the flip side. Do you get a sense, are people a little bit fatigued by the current setup in terms of the virtual online world, notwithstanding the benefits and the time back that you're getting, but are people missing the mixture of face-to-face contact? Do you get that sense?
I mean, obviously, I think a pandemic is kind of a difficult thing for people to live through, and people would like it to be over. But, you know, it doesn't change the fact that that is just an experience that we have to continue to live through until it's over. Depends, really. I feel like there's different sort of political strands of thought on this. There's definitely some who ideologically want to reimpose physical meetings, wise or not. For ideological reasons. You saw a lot of pressure, for example, for the European Parliament to go to Strasbourg. There's enormous frustration that they haven't been able to do that on behalf of the French, even though, I mean, for practical purposes, it doesn't make sense to do that in terms of the risk that it would pose to the people of Strasbourg, and as well as the mixing and upheaval that it would cause. And then also, you know, I think in lots of the, I would say, you know, the kind of among the political forces that are very concerned about the economy and so on, there was at a certain point I detected an ideological commitment to returning to face-to-face meetings as a matter of principle, even when they could be easily replaced by Zoom. So it's quite interesting. I think definitely, you know, we're all human. We like to have human contact. But I think, yeah, there are some who want to do it as a point of principle, sometimes a little bit illogically. Yeah.
Right. No, fair point. And just if I may, turning, Naomi, we might turn to that, the perennial topic, Brexit. It hasn't gone away, you know. You may have seen, we were delighted to announce at European Movement Ireland's AGM that the 2020 European of the Year awardee will be none other than Michel Barnier. So we've managed to break the Twitter machine with that one, so we're delighted, and hopefully we'll be able to figure out a way to present that award to him. But can I ask you, Naomi, from your perspective, where you see things are at in terms of the current state of play? I know we just had Vice President Šefčovič do a press briefing earlier. Where do you see things? Are you positive, or are you optimistic, or are you a little bit more pessimistic?
I'd say I'm probably pessimistic.
Really?
I mean, that's just a guess. Nobody really knows, apart from about maybe four people in London, what they actually want, because deliberately this is a sort of a psychological game of poker where they're trying to they're not always acting straightforwardly in pursuing their goal, so you know, maybe they don't want to deal. There's certainly some aspects of the British government that don't want to deal, and if those forces prevail, then there can't be a deal, because you need two sides to make one. So I mean, we don't know. The EU is just saying, okay, we're not going to react to the drama. We're never going to collapse the talks. They've made that very clear. They're never going to be the ones to walk out. So they'll keep talking and talking. But at a certain point, you know, the clock will run out. And it's interesting, from the British side, there seems to have been a bit of briefing going on in the last few days that there could be movement, there could be room for compromise and a pressure to go into the negotiating tunnel. There's a lot of obsession with the idea of a negotiating tunnel in London. It's kind of, you know, I don't know why that is, but it's when basically they stop talking to press for a while, and it's seen as a sign that they're close to an agreement and they're kind of ironing out the details, and then they'll come out the other side and announce things. But, you know, that's sort of a theatre, like asking to go into a tunnel just for the sake of it without actually having a purpose or some sort of grounds for compromise doesn't make any sense. And the EU has just said, we have to see what you want to agree before we, do anything like that. So, I mean, we'll have a better idea by Friday. But the one, I suppose, cause for optimism might be that perhaps this is a kind of theatre that's leading up to Prime Minister Boris Johnson compromising, but presenting the compromise as a victory and selling it to the public, because it seems that he has the public support and the majority in the parliament that would empower him to do that. But it really depends on what is in fact going on in his mind and those of his advisors, and we simply don't really know.
Exactly. And Naomi, you mentioned you thought there was four people, I think you said, in London, or that are up to speed with what's going on and what the thinking is. And to those four people, we'd love to have you on an episode of EM Ireland's Just the Chats podcast. So don't hesitate to get in touch with us. That would be fantastic. But Naomi, really, really good analysis of the state of play. Just from an Irish side, if I may, as you probably gathered, and no doubt the Irish Times and other media outlets reported on it, there was a huge sense here on the ground in Ireland of anger, of betrayal, a sense of betrayal, of disappointment with the UK Internal Markets Bill and the announcement by the Northern Ireland Secretary of State of the UK being willing to break that that international agreement. How did that go down from an EU perspective?
Shock. I think people were quite shocked and like, really? Truly, that they're doing this? There was a kind of scoop in the FT on, I think, the Sunday night indicating they were going to do that. And I think it was the Tuesday when it was confirmed by Brandon Lewis speaking in the House of Commons and declaring they were going to break international law. It's just bizarre, because it's one thing to kind of aim to break international law, but it's another thing to announce that you're going to do it, which is kind of bizarre behaviour. Because even people, even countries that do break international law usually don't announce it. So they usually defend themselves, and say like, we are abiding by our commitments or whatever. There was a lot of shock, confusion, questioning about why would they be doing that. A lot of observers concluded that that meant that they didn't want to deal, because it was so destructive. It's so destructive. So it makes it so difficult to get a deal if you're in the process ripping up the last one. Quite a lot of people looked at that and said, well, they're actually aiming for no deal. That's what they want. The reaction has been, we're not going to rise to this in case it's a provocation. We're just going to keep negotiating calmly. We won't be sort of provoked into walking out and then taking the blame for the collapse of the talks, if that's what happens. They've asked them to sort of think about it and think about not maybe introducing that bill. So yeah, we'll just have to see.
Exactly. And as you said, it's a busy time in store for the EU. And in terms of the council and the meeting of the leaders, have you any insight take on where you see that, or what you hope will be some of the outcomes for that?
This is part of the thing. So there are such a huge number of issues that the other EU member states want to iron out. Like, Brexit really is just so unwelcome. People just were over it, like a year ago, and just want to have it sort of tidied up and put to bed, because look, there's a global pandemic going on. This is posing unprecedented social, economic problems for countries. And there's a need to address that. On top of that, there are all of the geopolitical questions that the pandemic has sort of interrupted, but made more risky. So one thing is Belarus. Are they going to put on sanctions on Belarus? They've struggled to agree on that because of the blocking of Cyprus, because of Cyprus has basically been holding out for some sort of sanction on Turkey if it's going to sign up to sanctions on Belarus. Obviously, the aggressive policy of Turkey in the Eastern Mediterranean is a massive issue. Now we've got potentially a war breaking out between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and you can just keep on listing the number of huge geopolitical issues that the EU want to deal with, as well as like a very packed sort of internal policy making agenda by the Commission, whether it's like the new migration pact in terms of trying to agree some sort of common system to stop thousands of people having to sleep in the open air on the Greek islands, you know, to any number of reforms, some quite interesting ideas going on in terms of finance and banking union, where funnily enough, Ireland is gonna play quite a significant role. But yeah, there's a lot on the plate.
Yeah, and on that, Naomi, as you said, an absolutely packed schedule. And it was interesting, a couple of years ago, we did a survey amongst our European Movement International colleagues. David, you might recall this, where less than half of our European Movement International national councils had Brexit in their top three priorities. So very clearly, the EU has a massive agenda, and countries are understandably looking to deal with all these challenges that are hugely critical to the future of the European Union. You mentioned on the capital markets side of things, Naomi, which brings me neatly along to the upcoming commissioner hearings. What is the view on the ground? Obviously, Mairead McGuinness's hearing, with responsibility for the CMU, for financial services. That's going to be a really important portfolio, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Increasingly so. It's quite interesting. There was no commissioner in that role, specifically on that role, and until now. It's been carved out of the brief of the Latvian commissioner, Valdis Dombrovskis, and he's going to take over trade, making him a really enormous commissioner. But it means that to have someone who's viewed as smart and competent working on that portfolio specifically elevates it in terms of its prominence. Think just simple things like how many press conferences are going to have, like talking about it. You've got like one person whose main job it is to see through that brief, and that kind of indicates maybe the increased priority. And if you sort of zoom out a little bit about what's going on here, there's a big challenge that the EU is facing at the moment, because it relies on London for a lot of banking and finance services, and they want to create a capital markets in the EU, and also but you need a lot of things in order for that to be possible, including things like banking union. And so it's interesting that in order to pursue this, which is very coloured by the fact of Brexit happening, you have Irish people in very, very key positions, including Mairead McGuinness, who's, you know, almost certain to be confirmed as commissioner, but also Pascal Donoghue, the finance minister, who's president of the Eurogroup now. That's very much on his brief as well. And it'll be an interesting one. It's also going to probably, it's going to give an opportunity for a lot of people who are opposed to what's seen as the Irish approach to matters like banking, finance and tax, a lot of opportunities to criticize Ireland, to publicize their unhappiness on those policies, and to basically make Dublin feel a little bit uncomfortable. So that's probably something to expect as well.
So watch this space, Naomi, is what you're telling us on that.
Yeah, I imagine. I mean, so the hearings are going to be on Friday for Mairead McGuinness, and she's going to be in front of the Econ Committee taking questions and, being tested out for her plans and how good of a fit she is for the role. And I mean, the left-wing MEPs and the Greens have said that they are going to use it as an opportunity to kind of grill Ireland's record, really, on tax, banking and finance, which is quite interesting because, of course, commissioners are not supposed to represent their nation at all. They're supposed to be impartial and, in defending the interests of the whole EU, not that of their own member state. But nevertheless, they say that they're going to use this opportunity to just kind of gripe a little bit about about Ireland's perceived somewhat roguish tendencies on those issues.
Interesting. So the tax in Ireland, it appears in different guises, and it rears its head, doesn't it, on various occasions. But Naomi, in some of you mentioned Pascal Donoghue and Mairead McGuinness there. It's always something that we have said here in European Movement Ireland, but for a small country, the number of Irish people in senior levels in the EU institutions, we do tend to punch above our weight, or we like to think we do, and promoting and ensuring that pipeline remains active is something that our incredibly hardworking Brussels branch, chaired by David and our colleagues working across the PERM Rep, the Department of Foreign Affairs, and various other bodies and institutions are working really, really hard on to try and achieve. How do you see us as a country, and how are we viewed and portrayed on the other side of the Irish Sea, so to speak, Naomi? Because we saw the Economist article, obviously, talking about the incredible soft power that Ireland has diplomatically. Can we believe all that hype? Are we guilty of maybe drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit?
I mean, there's something to it, but it probably is a little bit overplayed. Ireland is quite effective. It does have an outsized amount of soft power, just and identity. You know, people know what Ireland is, and other countries of similar size can't necessarily take that for granted. That special relationship with Washington is playing absolute dividends at the moment. Very odd for a small country to get a yearly appointment every St. Patrick's Day over, you know, with the superpower. So that's, you know, there are real assets there. In terms of the situation in the EU, well, you can see why people would suddenly be saying, oh, like, well, what's Ireland doing so right? Like, they've got the UN Security Council seat, they've got Pascal Donoghue won, defeated Spain to, you know, get the Eurogroup presidency to the shock of some, and despite the preferences of France and Germany. Obviously, also, like, Mairead McGuinness getting a not a bad portfolio after Dublin's kind of turning on Phil Hogan, ruffled a few feathers in Brussels anyway. So yeah, there's a number of cases where you can point to successes, and Ireland has been very much in the spotlight because of the Brexit saga. You know, the whole thing has been like a big rehearsal about Irish interests and politics and history and so on. But having said that, there's also risks for Ireland as well. Ireland is geographically off to one side of Europe, and it has the potential to be geographically pretty isolated. There's also a risk of linguistic isolation. So we can have our Eastern European colleagues to thank really for the continued use, prominent use of English in EU affairs. But there's a very strong backlash from France, who say that, you know, they're very active in wanting to reorientate linguistically the EU to French and to get rid of English, especially now that Britain has left. And yeah, just to downplay it, they think that English is too dominant. And I have to say, it's really noticeable how much of a weakness that is. I mean, there's so many Irish figures working in Brussels who just don't have languages, and it really isolates people. You know, it isolates them in terms of the jobs that they can get, the relationships that they can form, and it's a problem. It's a problem for Ireland. It's something that Ireland will need if it wants to continue to be like a charismatic and effective actor, particularly diplomatically.
Naomi, that's absolutely fascinating, because it's been something we have been campaigning on for decades, right? To get Irish graduates and to encourage and promote greater language learning. And of course, Gaeilge being an official language, but also to encourage that language learning as part of the Blue Star program, the primary school's foreign languages initiative. Talk to me a little bit more about this linguistic backlash. Do you think the fact is it that English has become the lingua franca for Irish people, that we need to really upskill on the languages more broadly? Is that holding us back in terms of promotion?
Oh, definitely. It holds Irish people back in terms of promotion, for sure. Yeah, definitely. It's just unusual for, like, you get a lot of people who struggle with other languages from Ireland, and it's understandable. It's not just us, it's all the Anglophone countries. So you'd have a similar sort of phenomenon in Australia and things like that. You can, if you want to, you can totally insulate yourself from having to hear other languages, because English is so dominant. You can live in a totally Anglophone world if you seek to avoid the other languages. But yeah, definitely, it's a weakness in terms of Ireland's clout, and it's something that I think, you know, we don't know. Like, the English has been embedded so much as a lingua franca in many settings that possibly we can continue to ride on that. But I think it would be a strategic mistake to assume that that's stable, and I think it's just isolating. There are so many conversations, not just at the official level but the unofficial level, where, you know, Irish people are excluded just because of the linguistic issue.
Fascinating. And David, would you find that? I know from having attended European Movement International events with your good self that you are not a bad linguist at all. But do you find, can you empathize with what Naomi's saying? Would you agree with that sentiment?
Absolutely. I think there's two trends that will impact this. I mean, the first is France is becoming more and more influential within the European institutions and within the council. You know, soon Merkel will retire, Macron will you know be the I think will for a large extent set the agenda of the European Union if he's re-elected. And I think, you know, they, as Naomi said, they constantly mention the presence of the language or the presence of the French language within the institutions, and that's going to continue. So there's that, and then there is, you know, the fact that the graduates of 2020 are coming out of colleges, sometimes perfectly bilingual, sometimes perfectly trilingual, from across Europe. And it's more and more difficult for cosseted people like us, you know, in our English language bubble, to compete in job competitions when your first language, you know, would be English, your second language would be, you know, a learned language. But a lot of the competition are absolutely perfectly bilingual. They've either grown up between two countries, they have parents from two countries, or whatever. So I think you know, it's a great success of the European project that there are these type of people who want to work in Europe and want to work with Europe and for the European project. But it does, as Naomi said, you know, bring home the point again that we are off to the side, we're isolated, we're not, you know, we don't have any more physical border within a EU country. We need to integrate at every level, socially, culturally, economically, with the EU in order to succeed into the future, or else you know, charisma only gets us so far. It gets us far enough, but, you know, I think that will end at some point.
Charisma and charm, David, right? No, and really, really, really excellent points. I mean, David, I just wonder, do you find, and Naomi, maybe it's a bit different, but it struck me when I worked in France, I would have people constantly trying to practice their English on me, even when their English was appalling, and, you know, my French would have been far, far better than their attempts at English. So to be fair, I wonder, are we victims of people wanting to practice their English? I don't know, David, if you find that in work meetings or conferences that you probably have to take part in.
I think we're not confident about our language skills as a race. We're, as you say, sometimes even when our language is better, we don't have that confidence or that desire to jump in and try the language. And I think that holds us back. And for sure, everyone loves to have, you know, a native English speaker to practice with. But, you know, if the sum total of your role within a company or an organization is to be the draft, you know, to do the spell check, you know, it's not great. It's a foot in the door, but I think you need to get to the next level and to really make an impact and influence within the EU institutions, in the private sector, within NGO land, wherever. You really need to be able to have you know, a good command of a number of languages and be able to you know, as Naomi said, have those back kind of chats, discuss things. I think, I don't know who it was, I think it was one of the German chancellors says, you know, if we're selling to you, you know, we will speak English, but if you're selling to us in Germany, you will speak German. And I think that's how it goes. You know, if you want to push your agenda you need to do it in the language of the country that you're pushing it with.
So maybe a couple of tips there for the Brexit negotiators with the German car manufacturers, right?
Absolutely. I haven't heard they're on the way, but if I do see them passing by Brussels on the way to influence the negotiations, I'll let you know first.
Oh no, it's fine. You can maybe let London know first, David. No, that's great. Listen, my last question, David, might be to you. As I mentioned, you're our chair of our Brussels branch, and it's probably been a challenge to try and host what would have been our traditional events and engagements and support to our members and the Irish community in Brussels. How are things with our hardworking committee?
Yeah, things are well. It's been more difficult to do the normal events, as you say, that we would have. Last year we did a jobs kind of fair with some of the new stagiaires to try to encourage them to stay in Brussels, which is something that we always try to do with the Brussels Connection event as well. Those kind of events aren't possible anymore. You know, we're looking at new ways of communicating through this podcast, for example, through social media. But yeah, no doubt, you know, civic life and those kind of opportunities are that bit more of a challenge now. But yeah, we're optimistic to see how we can use different technologies to try to reach out to the Brussels, to the Irish community here in Brussels, which is our role at the end of the day. Any hints or tips, we're delighted to participate.
Fantastic. No, thank you both very much. Naomi, could I just turn lastly to you? Given all your work and your engagement and having that finger on the pulse across Europe more broadly, where do you see things from an Irish EU perspective? Obviously, we have very high levels of support here in Ireland for our continuing membership of the European Union. But do you see a rise in Euroscepticism, in populism? Do you see that impacting more broadly across the different member states?
I think it's an error to talk about Euroscepticism as if it's one monolithic thing across the EU. So there's lots of different sorts of unhappiness with the EU, and they can mean diametrically opposite things. So for example, in Italy, people might be more like disappointed Europhiles who want more from Brussels and feel abandoned and, you know, want more support. Whereas in the Netherlands, it's the opposite, and their Euroscepticism might take the form of wanting less Europe, you know, a cheaper Europe and so on. So there is Euroscepticism is an element in many national politics, but usually it's locally specific. And no doubt if it becomes a factor in Ireland and Irish politics in a way that it hasn't been in the past, it will again be something that's culturally specific to the political situation in Ireland. I think that it's a moment of opportunity for Ireland in terms of the EU. Everybody knows about Ireland and its interests now, but we need to stop looking at the EU through the lens of Brexit. There's a lot more issues on the table. And I think there needs to be some really clear strategic thinking about what Ireland's interests are. And it might involve some difficult decisions. There are difficult trade-offs. The geographical situation is complicated in terms of not being part of Schengen and having the common travel area. This has really isolated Ireland in a way that was underlined during the pandemic because of the way that we physically got cut off. I mean, the island of Ireland having a 2-week blanket quarantine and going down a different path from all of the other EU countries literally made the European Commission come up with a new phrase, which just means all of the EU countries except for Ireland, when it was making all of its policy to try and bring travel, to reopen free travel in the rest of the EU during the pandemic. And that was just a sort of symbol of how Ireland can end up being isolated. It needs to be properly engaged with the debates and priorities that are going on in Brussels, and not their Brexit is going to just keep declining, I think, in terms of priority. And there's a lot more issues coming down the track where I think Ireland could do with having a more robust and more strongly articulated view on how that should be shaped. You know, what kind of Europe does Ireland want to have?
Couldn't agree with you more, Naomi, and that's something that we in European Movement Ireland are going to be the fore in championing and looking to debate and engage with, because frankly, if we don't, we won't have that ability and that opportunity to be at the table and to make sure that our perspective on all of this is being discussed and debated where it counts. So thank you very much, Naomi, for that. And David, a big thank you to you as well. Really enjoyed our Just the Chats Brussels podcast special. I think it's fair to say with Naomi and David, we could have gone on for hours and hours, but sadly we have to draw proceedings to a conclusion. Naomi, David, thank you both very much. Stay well and safe and keep doing what you're doing, and you're both playing a blinder. Thank you very much for taking the time to chat to us today for European Movement Ireland's Just the Chats podcast. A hugely fascinating Just the Chats podcast that was. A massive thank you to Chair of European Movement Ireland's Brussels branch, David Garrahy, and Irish Times European correspondent, Naomi O'Leary. Fair to say, we could have gone on for many hours, so I'm really hoping that we'll have Naomi and David back on a later episode of our Just the Chats podcast series. A big thank you to you, our listeners, and to all our subscribers and followers. If you want to keep an eye on some of our Just the Chats podcasts that we have coming down the track, please make sure that you're following us across all our social media platforms. And in the meantime, stay well and safe. Thank you very much.